everyone. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Lid Radio Podcasts. I am your host for today, Francesca. And for this episode, we have two very special guests with us, Rasmus Holland and Colin Shearer. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Great. So Rasmus is a thought leader within omnichannel and digital marketing. Through more than a decade with major Scandinavian agencies, he's worked with some of the largest brands in the Nordics. His work as a consultant and an author has helped him to build his knowledge of marketing and CRM. Since 2015, he's been Chief Strategy Officer with the marketing technology company Agilic. Colin has been a pioneer and thought leader in AI and advanced analytics for over 25 years. His experience ranges from successful startups and the creation of market-leading tools and technology. He designed and developed the Clementine Data Mining System, now IBM SPSS Modeler, to worldwide executive roles with the largest vendors. In December 2016, Colin joined Houston Analytics, a Finland-based European leader in artificial intelligence, and became Chief Strategy Officer. In their book, Make It All About Me, Rasmus and Colin have created a comprehensive manual to help marketers leverage omnichannel and AI for marketing and business success. Using their transformational framework, the Omnichannel Hexagon, companies will learn how to profit on consumer data insights to gain and retain true customer focus when adopting different technologies. This book is a practical guide to mastering the six essential omnichannel disciplines and thus collaborating towards optimal balance between achieving customer centricity and doing profitable business. So about the book, it explains how businesses can apply the omnichannel strategy to their own company, but this may not always be easy as we know. There are entrepreneurs and managers that probably do not know the difference between multi-channel and omnichannel marketing. So for those who are not experts on the topic, how can they start the omnichannel transformation?
All right, I can start answering that, if you're all right with that, Colin.
Of course, yes.
So actually, I see a few questions within this. And the first one probably is, what is the difference between multi-channel and omnichannel marketing? And I would say to begin with, there is a difference now. But I think when multi-channel was first coined, it actually, the meaning was, it was meant to mean the same as we as what we call omnichannel marketing now, but in hindsight is always 2020. So looking back at it now, you can say that in the sort of the multi-channel paradigm, brands and companies were indeed communicating with their customers across a wide variety of channels, but it wasn't really connected, it wasn't orchestrated, so it's more like the same message that was repeated on multiple channels.
Sure.
Whereas with omnichannel marketing, obviously more channels have arrived, but also what we're starting to see is that people are actually starting to orchestrate their communication and their marketing across these channels. So as an end customer, you get like a coherent experience, not having to start over if you change from one communication channel to the other. So I think that sort of narrows down the difference there is between multi-channel and omnichannel marketing in terms of the output, at least. And the issue here, the reason why we had to do a book about it, or one of the reasons was that, or is that in order to actually do this orchestration and make it all come together for each individual end customer, it often takes profound change of how companies are organized and how they think about this, because it really has to. You really have to kill all the silos within your organization. You really have to start making people work together, come together, speak the same language in order for the business to actually succeed. So that's probably one of the biggest differences. So for the end customer, it's about making the customer experience more coherent when they move across channels. But that has tremendous impact on how organizations are designed and how you work with this. So how to start the omnichannel transformation? Well, first of all, I think you need to realize that this is, in fact, a very profound change that you'd be looking to achieve and that you'd be embarking on. So that'd be the first thing to see and to admit to yourself.
Yeah.
And then depending on whether or not, these things, the transformations always start with senior management buy-in. So if you don't have that already, that's what you should strive to achieve. And if you find that you can never achieve that, and then I think you're probably better off looking for another job.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm saying tongue in cheek. But say that you do have the say that you do have the buy-in from senior management and from your CEO. First of all, you probably need to make sure that if you are indeed the CMO, that you are the one appointed for heading this omnichannel transformation. So make sure you have the mandate and you have the buy-in, and you actually start from then on speaking the same language. So often when we do talks, we reference the Tower of Babel, a metaphor with the Tower of Babel, that using that as an analogy. Because if you think back to pre-Mosaic times, what you really what people were doing back then, they were building this Tower of Babel, reaching up all the way into the heavens. And the pre-Mosaic God, he didn't fancy that much, so he flooded the country with digital transformation. So suddenly people were preoccupied with their own individual new digital tools, and they suddenly started not being able to understand each other anymore, and the tower fell apart. Yeah. So sort of a parallel to where we are now. So the first thing is to actually to establish a common language for discussing and talking about omnichannel marketing across the organization. And that's actually what we're trying to do with the book.
Brilliant.
No, I was just going to say, I've come to the omnichannel world somewhat later than Rasmus, who's really been in and seen it through a certain entire evolution. But to me, when you look at multi-channel and omnichannel, you know, I see a big difference between, if you like, the tactical and the strategic and visionary. So everybody sees the benefits now, or indeed are having to operate in more and more channels. But in multi-channel, it's the quick, tactical, kludgy approach that says we join individual channels together. We link them up with string and sealing wax. And we don't get that sort of unification, that sort of consistency, that sort of single view that we're talking about in omni-channel. So omni-channel is the big picture. It's the grand unification of everything you know about the customer and every way you interact with that, with the customer. But what's important is that, you know, that can seem scary, because you've got to make a huge transformation. That doesn't have to be a big bang transformation. You can still take your tactical steps towards that. But the important thing is that as you join more channels together around the central unified view of the customer, that you are still doing so with that key vision and the key directive, that you keep the consistency in how you know the customer and how you operate to them.
Sure. Okay, brilliant. I mean, you present the book as a tool for marketers, so using your omnichannel hexagon as like a main model for transformation. And just going through the hexagon, the customer's obviously in the centre, and the six sides of the hexagon are conformed by sort of 1, customer recognition and permissions, 2, data collection, 3, data analytics and AI, 4, communication and service, 5, performance analysis, and 6, organising and management. But I do have a question. You do answer it in the book, but for those listening, where is the product in this hexagon?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, first of all, this is a tool for marketers.
Yeah.
And then if you look at sort of the standard or the normal or the most common areas of responsibility for marketers, they rarely have responsibility for developing the product. So really putting the product in there as a like a slice of its own, as a discipline within the omnichannel hexagon, I think that would transcend the areas of responsibility for marketers in general. So in that extent, it makes sense to leave it out in a marketing model. Okay. That said, you can definitely apply some of the same data collection and the data analytics and AI for doing product development or developing your product even further. So that's just without the scope of the hexagon here, but definitely something that we suggest that R&D departments worldwide do look into.
Sure.
Second, I'd say that that depending on which kind of company you're in, I would say that the product, or perhaps more precisely, the product experience can be greatly enhanced and affected by doing omnichannel marketing correctly. Are doing that to a great extent. Because if you look at, for instance, one of our clients, Storytel, audiobook company, so they have this app through which they provide their end customers with audiobooks, so you can listen to flat rate as many audiobooks as you like, and you can also read ebooks. Of course, you can say that the app is the product, but the communication that you get on top of that the communication that entices you to put a new book on your reading list or listen to your next book or whatever keeps you engaged. It's really hard to tell whether that's part of the product or whether that's not part of the product. So in any case, it's part of the product experience. So you can say in that way, you could argue that the omnichannel marketing done right does indeed affect the product, or at least the product experience.
Yeah, I think that's well put, Rasmus. And when you talk about product, or trying to make that central in marketing, you begin to think about something which is more centered around that, and almost seems more transactional. As Rasmus said, it's a lot more about the experience and the relationship with the customer that the organization has. When we did the book launch in the UK, we were lucky to have a guest came along, Eric Tyree from Carlson Wagonly, and they provide corporate travel services. So in some way, their product is effectively selling business flights and hotel bookings, but actually they effectively stay with the traveler throughout their journey. So they are giving them advice and recommendations on how to get to where they're going, on what to do and see, and what fun things to do when they're staying in a particular area, right through to even preempting problems with their travels, like aircraft delays and so on, and preemptively offering to rebook them. So it's just making the point, it's not just this single object, this product that you sell them, it's the entire relationship around that, which may not be solely based around trying to sell more of the product. It's based around deepening and engendering a more close customer relationship.
Yeah, I think if you put this into the perspective of retailers, obviously they'll be dealing with a lot of products. So not the product, but they're looking at, of course, their assortment, their product offering, the amount of products that they keep in their inventory and they choose to sell. You can look at those as the product. But moreover, you'd look at the customer experience as their product, because that's really what will distinguish this particular retailer in front of others. So the way that they curate their assortment, how they put that together, how they put their brand together, which stories they decide to tell accompanying the products that they sell. So you could argue that for retailers, that would even be considered the product. At least that's sort of the main offering that is distinguishing them from competitors such as Amazon and such.
Sure. Okay, great. I mean, we've kind of talked about how how you put the customer in the centre, and there's this emphasis in the book on personalisation to make a relevant customer journey. So there's a lot of controversy at the moment, though, about how personalisation is becoming intrusive, people even sort of believing that their phones are spying on them. So what are the dangers of personalisation, and where do you think the line is between a personalised product and service? Between something that's a bit more invasive or even creepy?
I think that's an excellent topic. If you look at what marketing has been trying to do over recent years, we're going from an era where you threw things out there at the customer and hope some of it stuck, sure, to realizing that consumers really today expect relevance. Things that aren't relevant, turn them off. And not only will they ignore them, they will sometimes very actively disconnect from your brand and become a detractor. And so what we're seeing with the technologies, the ability to use data today, is going from this era of scattergun junk mail, and people being swamped in a deluge of totally irrelevant information, to the ability to target. But we're seeing that used sometimes in ways that are naive or sometimes thoughtless. And I think this is where you could say a little knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Which is when you happen to see a potential customer has looked at something, you just keep bombarding them again and again and again about that thing. And I had an experience myself a few months ago. One of our antique radiators was broken. We had a plumber in who was fixing it, but didn't give it a lot of chance of survival. And if he couldn't fix it, I had to look for a replica one. So I once visited a website showing these replica Victorian radiators. The plumber fixed it, bless him, that same day. And yet, for about 3 months afterwards, every feed I went to, I was seeing these damn radiators from this company. So I got a little bit fed up with that. And I'm not so much a creepy, but it was just rather a blunt instrument that was being used. Now, what can we really do today? And the answer is, with the data that we have, that consumers provide to us, we can really understand them in a lot of detail. We can understand what sort of things interest them, what sort of things would not be interesting to them, when they would be interesting to them, when they move to a particular part of the life cycle, when something becomes relevant, and so on. So we have a lot of ability to actually reason about what should be the right things to show them, that they should react positively to at the right time. Now, sometimes it's as well to not go as far as you can. I've worked with at least one telco organization that has huge potential in having lots of location data that they could use and decided consciously not to. They decided that would be too intrusive, basically targeting people based on exactly where they were at any point in time. But we can take the data we have, we can take the ability to build things like predictive models and propensity models to understand what's going to be relevant to them, and we can even go further. We can know times of the day when people will be receptive, and therefore when might be a good time to contact them that they wouldn't find intrusive, for example. But we can also model their sensitivity. And I don't know of many organizations doing this yet, but if you think that, you know, something that I might find really intrusive and slightly disconcerting, you know, Rasmus might think, hey, that's really cool. I really like the way the guys have done that. So in the same way that we're learning that people have different characteristics and different, you know, tolerances and preferences for things, we have the potential, I think, to understand who could be most sensitive. And I don't mean just, you know, set a bar that says don't contact this person about radiators more than 7 times a week.
Sure.
I'm really trying to understand, you know, who is interested, who should only see a particular thing once, and who might be somebody who will be susceptible to more gentle nudges. But it's a very fine line, and it's a different line probably for every consumer.
Yeah, I agree with you, Colin, actually, all your points here. Because, and I think the point about the fact that people are reacting negatively to personalization is, in fact, because it's done very poorly. So, in fact, I feel that mostly people are reacting more to mindless retargeting, as you describe it here, with radiators. They're reacting more to that than they are to personalization done right. Because if you do personalization right, it actually feels helpful, something that can help you move on. So instead of, so I recently became a father again, and so we're looking a lot at baby stuff, obviously. So if I'm looking for like a pushchair, for instance, chances are I'll be buying a pushchair fairly soon. And if it's just a simple retargeting script picks that up, it'll just start showing me pushchairs from now on and forever. Whereas what I really need is, I mean, once I've seen X amount of pushchairs, just showing me more of those won't entice me or get me closer to any purchase. What I'd really need is a purchase guide. So what are the things that I should consider when I'm looking for a pushchair? So actually changing the conversation from mindless retargeting more into how can we help you, or even asking people, so did you already purchase a pushchair? If you see that people aren't responding to it, and then you can get on with your marketing budget, spend that in more clever ways. Also, I agree with the point that people have different levels of, that they feel about, have different feelings about personalization. So some will find it, something's creepy. So I think especially the older you get, there's a tendency that you feel more creeped out about personalization. So that's sort of one dimension there. Another one is which kind of data are you actually doing the personalization on? Because in the example also that that Colin mentioned, people may not be aware that the phone company is collecting data on your physical whereabouts. But it will be completely natural for them if you do personalization on transactions that you've made with them, because they you'd be pretty aware that they have this data available, and thus you won't be creeped out if they suddenly use that personalization. Also, there's the level to which you address the fact that you know this data. So you can either address that very directly, and you can do that for, say, that someone purchased something from you, and you know that for a fact, then it's all right to address that very directly. Whereas if you aren't really sure, if it's more like a propensity, or if you think there's a high chance that someone would be interested in something, then you shouldn't address it as directly as you should it with something that you have deterministic data on, where you're completely sure that this is in fact the case. It could be more subtle, just maybe even just using the timing and the segmenting for just having a message that is more subtle, but it just happens to be super relevant for most of the audience that you're putting it in front of.
Brilliant. And thank you for the examples of the baby products and the antique radiators. I did want to talk a bit more about examples. So in your book and in the talks you give, you do use quite a few examples of different companies that have used omnichannel strategy to kind of exemplify their methods. Can you tell our listeners about a well-executed omnichannel strategy from a real business?
There are a lot of examples of this. And when I did the sort of the first Danish version of the book, that's 5 years ago, I would say there were few and far between. the cases there. So luckily, what has happened with omnichannel and omnichannel strategy is that it's gone from being sort of a marketer's pipe dream to actually becoming a valid business strategy.
Sure.
So me working primarily out of the Scandinavian and the UK market, obviously my examples will be mostly from these areas. But I would say to pick a sort of a more let's pick a US example just to raise the bar a bit. In the book, we also talk about the North Face, which you probably know is a North American based outdoor apparel manufacturer and retailer. So they've actually gone to great lengths to not only build their core story and their purpose and their products, but also to get to know their customers to a very, very wide extent. So they're continuously collecting data from the end customers or the users of their products, looking into how people are, of course, which products people are buying, but also which locations they are visiting and they are exploring. So through their app, for instance, you can go and discover the great outdoors, and you can check in at certain points in the outdoors to save up points. They also look at which events they're doing, a lot of events for local events for their audience. So, for instance, if you attend a rock climbing event in LA or in San Francisco, this will be added to your profile to your customer profile, and from then on they'll start flavoring the communication that you get more towards rock climbing. In this case, could be skiing, could be trekking, could be all other kinds of outdoor activities that you could use their products for. So they're really going to great lengths to establish this relationship with their end customers and cater and personalize the communications toward these people to create better better brand loyalty and ultimately better sales.
As Rasmus was saying, that's a great example of how an organization has really applied omnichannel very, very effectively in its customer relationships. If you look at towards the end of the hexagrams, you begin to monitor the performance and track what you're doing. It's interesting to see how this has fed through, not just to the bottom line, but even how public companies report themselves to the street. If you look at Nordstrom, for example, they've been doing some very interesting things, not just to execute omnichannel marketing, but also to really pivot and to orient their reporting around customer engagement. So if you join one of their quarterly calls, you'll hear all sorts of metrics, all sorts of KPIs about how well they're doing with customer engagement. And then they've done a detailed analysis about how the deeper the customer engagement is and the different steps they've reached in that equate to deeper customer, to greater customer value that's generated. So they can track this through, to direct monetary value all the way from the omnichannel approach they've taken from the start.
Yeah, brilliant.
Perhaps as a third example, you could look at how Sephora are going about their omnichannel strategy and how they're executing that. And I think mainly they are worth noting for how they are working with, first of all, how they do their departments and structures. So they've put customer service, digital, and retail under one one report. So we have the head of Omni Retail, who's heading these three departments that used to be sort of more siloed.
Yeah.
So you'll have no personal incentive schemes getting in the way of the customer experience. So that's one way. Another thing that's worth noting in how they are going about this is the way that they are educating their staff for the retail stores. So they actually so when you become employed with Sephora, at least in the in North America, you're actually not employed as a sales associate as you would be in most retailers. You're employed as a beauty advisor, and that alone gives you a sense of purpose. Also gives you some hints to the more sort of over the counter, let me take them on, and you can have the product. Interactions are being more automated, and more time is left for actually doing the beauty advising. So the beauty advisors are obviously advising people on how they can become more beautiful versions of themselves. And to become so, they have employed a very, very large education scheme for new employees. So they're actually teaching them how to use the wide array of digital tools in the physical store that is then interconnected with the digital communication channels. So say, for instance, that you would, through the app, you try on makeup in the same way as you'd employ a Snapchat filter. So you can virtually try on makeup, and then you can go to a beauty makeover. You could book a beauty makeover in the store. Once you get there, you'll be trying on different products that will then be added to your digital profile, and you should expect to see those products become more prominent in the communication that you'd get from then on, in the email and in the app and on the website and so on. So they're really taking this to great lengths. Also, the whole way that they're talking about working in the retail space is different. First of all, there's the beauty advisor instead of the sales associate, the naming of your title. There's also the fact that you are whoever's at work a specific day, they're referred to as the cast, sort of a movie thing there, spreading a bit of glamour over at working in Sephora. Also, if you are on the floor servicing customers, you are on stage, and if you are in the back getting products and whatnot, doing management there, you are off stage. So this is the way that they're doing a whole changing the language and thus changing the culture of how they are they're doing their omnichannel work. I think they've taken this to great lengths. I'm fairly impressed with that.
That's a really great example. I mean, you've absolutely sold me on Sephora, so I hope you're working on commission.
not exactly, yeah.
So lastly, your model emphasises the importance of data collection and how the different levels of data can get you closer to the customer. But how should this data be used? How can businesses take all the big data and map each customer with their ideal product or message?
Well, there are right ways and wrong ways to go about that. There is such a hype at the moment around big data and AI that, you know, there's a sort of data excitement is often prevalent in the market, where people understand that they've been told by vendors they've got these wonderful data assets, they could do magic with them, and all you need to do is throw it at some smart algorithms, or even better, get one of these incredibly smart people, these data scientists, the so-called sexiest job of the 21st century, and bring them in and set them loose on the data, and magic will happen. And well, sadly, it doesn't. But in an area like this, where we're trying to effectively deepen the customer relationship, there are certain objectives, and it's got to be those objectives that drive what we do with the data that we've collected. And in this case, as we're trying to improve on marketing, we can use machine learning algorithms that look at the data that automatically find patterns. For example, that can be combinations of products that tend to appeal to the same people. It can tend to be sequences of purchases or activities or investments, if you're a bank or something like that, that people tend to make, that help the marketers begin to visualize more about the journey and more about the preferences. The algorithms can do clustering, what you might call auto-segmentation. And you've got a slight conflict in language here, because segmentation has a meaning in marketing, but typically that has been a case of marketers really superimposing their own beliefs on the data, believing they're dealing with segments of older people who like radiators or whatever, or younger people who don't mind being pestered 17 times a day with things about carry cots and pushchairs and so on. But the point is, these algorithms can automatically find what the real groupings are in the data, tell you what describe these different clusters of people, these different segments, and then that gives the marketers the right ideas of how to address them and what might be relevant, even back to what products should be developed to suit their needs. The algorithms, the technologies that they then, of course, can look forwards as well. This is where the predictive part of analytics comes in. We're looking at historical data, people responding to certain offers, of buying different things and so on, can actually feed into the ability for systems to learn how to take any new contact with a person or any new prospect or whatever and decide what the right thing is to offer to them at the right time and such like. Or the prompt, or I should say, will at least be able to predict how likely it is they will respond, what their propensity is, let's say, to respond to being contacted in a certain way. And you can go to great depths in this. You can produce very, very powerful models of the customer's behavior. You can predict different facets of their preferences, of how what they're going to buy, how much they're going to spend with you, how loyal they will stay, what the risk is of them going to a competitor, and so on. But no matter how good these things are technically, no matter how much work you put into fine-tuning the accuracy of these predictive models and validating the segments that the system's automatically discovered for you, none of that matters until you turn it into action. And what that's about is changing a set of, if you like, almost maths, a set of scores, a set of probabilities, a set of knowledge about what people want and what they're likely to do and what they'll prefer and so on, into decisions about what is the right thing for them. Now, that might mean where we look at several different possible offers we can make or several different actions we can take towards them and resolving them into what is the right one, what we call next best action. So optimize around that. But also, there's then the question about where and when do we take the actions based on it. And this is where we move into the area of how we go from the analysis and the knowledge and insight and foresight of the customer into driving communication and interactions, where we're taking the customer life cycle, the customer journey, if you like, and we're looking for the particular points in that, the particular moments that are critical, where adding this sort of database intelligence can take us in the right direction, can add to a net positive in the relationship with them by communicating the right thing to them in the right way at the right time. Rasmus, do you want to enter anything on the communication side, the execution side?
Yes, so I completely agree with you, Colin, that once you have all this wonderful data in place, it's really of no use if you don't take it into how you optimize your customer experience. And if you look at how marketers have been working ever since Eve was selling apples, I think the campaign way of looking at things, where you have your yearly cycle with your campaigns being lined up in line with as the seasons come by, so you have the first night of the fall where you have frost in the night, that could be like an occasion for communicating something. When the summer vacation, a school holiday starts, that would be sort of an occasion for communicating or doing your campaigns. When you have your spring release of new products and so on. So these occasions for thinking about campaigns also with Christmas and Easter and Black Friday and whatnot. I think in general, this is how marketers have been working, and they rarely struggle coming up with ideas for doing these campaigns. And we're not suggesting that people abandon sort of the old ways of doing campaigns, because that would still pay some of the bills and the salaries, that you'll still earn a lot of money by doing the campaigns. But we can indeed use these data for, and namely, the propensity scores and the auto segments that will be applied to each customer object. That will be for personalizing and segmenting your campaigns to a greater degree, which will then give you a fairly big uplift on that. Then what you need to do, which is probably fairly different to how many marketers have been working so far, that's, as Colin says, that's applying this to the customer journey. So not looking at this as from a campaign perspective, but from a customer lifecycle perspective, where the data analytics will tell you a great deal of where in their customer journey each individual customer is, and thus which message would be appropriate for them at this time. So that's another way of working. So setting up automated customer lifecycle flows that are listening for these patterns in data, actually knowing on this basis, what would be the right timing for each individual customer to receive this message? How should we communicate this? Which tone of voice? Which line of argumentation? What is the motivation that we need to address for this particular customer? So, and that's sort of a more long-term discipline to get into. So building up gradually more and more automated customer lifecycle flows that will then day after day deliver consistent value creation for you as a business, but also be considered very helpful for the end customer. So, and what we see working is really when organizations are dividing their team, so they have some part of the marketing team who's working mainly with doing personalization of the campaigns to a great extent. They have a separate team focusing on more long-term building of customer lifecycle communication flows that both then are applied across channels. So we're not only talking about owned media, such as email, text messages, in-app, app push notifications, and websites, but also into how you deploy these
this knowledge and these insights into how you're applying paid media. So you are eventually spending your media budget in a much more clever way, with greater returns and actually reducing the cost that you have on paid media.
Lastly, anyone interested in knowing more from you and your omnichannel model can of course get a copy of the book, Make It All About Me by Rasmus Holland and Colin Shearer. But where else can they find you if they want to find out more?
Well, I think we're definitely available for a chat if you connect through us with us through LinkedIn. So that would be a good place to find us. You can also go to the to our website, the website for the book, makeitallaboutmebook.com, where you can find contact details. You can find us on Twitter as well. And you're welcome to come visit us. I'm mostly in either London, Copenhagen, or Stockholm, so you can come visit us at the offices there. Colin, you'll probably be mostly, Finland, Scotland, all over the world?
Finland and Scotland, so the colder parts of the world, but you're very happy, you're very welcome to come and visit me here as well.
Excellent. We could do a road trip all the way around the world.
So we're quite often doing talks at trade shows and events, such as the Martech Festival and whatnot. So come see us there. We'll most likely be talking at some event near you in the time to come. So check out our website for where you can meet us next. And we're really interested in hearing from as many people as possible who have read the book or maybe used the Omnichannel Hexagon for their own organizational work. Also worth noting, actually, we didn't cover this until now, it's possible to do a maturity test that will tell you, gauge how far are you currently in the omnichannel transformation, and you can compare that result to peers or to a benchmark within your specific industry. So that should be worth looking into as well. You can find the link to that on the book website as well, makeitallaboutmebook.com.
Brilliant. Well, I urge everyone to get in touch then. Thank you so much, Rasmus and Colin, for joining us today. It's been a great conversation. And thanks for everyone else for listening. So don't forget to keep an eye on our social media at Lib Publishing on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. For more information about new books, experts and opinions, and of course more podcast episodes, thought leaders such as Rasmus and Colin. So I'll see you next time on Lib Radio Podcast.